I'm really excited to be here. I've never tried talking to the public before, so I hope I can make sense. So what I'm going to do today is basically tell you three things. So my first point is how we can use yeast to help us understand human disease. And actually, Brian O'Rourke's talk really sets it up for me, because what you could see is sometimes they're finding mutations in genes that we don't know anything about at all. So it's hard to tell whether the mutation is actually linked to autism or not, because we just don't know what that gene does. And so what I'm going to show you is that if we take a parallel approach of just asking very basic questions in biology, how does something work? We're going to learn about new genes. We're going to learn how they work, and then if we find there's a mutation there that's linked to autism or Alzheimer's or cancer, we're going to have a much better guess. Is this the right candidate gene? Does this mutation make sense? And that's what I'm going to be showing all of you. So the second point of my talk is that you too can be a scientist, whether you're a student or a high school teacher, or wherever you are in life, it's not too late. And I love being a scientist. And so I'm going to convince you, or I'm going to do my best, that science is really fun. It is really fun. And I feel really privileged that this is what I get to do in my life. It's all about puzzles and figuring out puzzles and coming up with ideas and asking questions. And the most exciting part for me is every once in a while, now I have to admit, does not happen every day, but every once in a while, I see something and I realize I am the first person to see this, and that is the best feeling. And actually, I have to admit that now I have a lab, so I'm not doing most of the experiments that I'm going to show you, and so I'm actually not the first person to see it. I'm the second. But I share in the excitement of the first person who saw it, and the second's pretty good too. And then the third point that I want to make is that it's really important for us as a society and for us as people to support very basic research where we don't really know where we're going. We don't know what we're going to discover. Because what I think is that if we ask a question that's important enough, we're going to get answers that are going to better human life. And so that's my third point. Okay, so what we are interested in my lab is how do events within cells happen at the right place and at the right time? So I'm just curious, does anyone know what this picture is over here? I have three pictures up there. I just have no idea what the level is here. Is like this obvious or? You can talk to your neighbor and ask, try it out on your neighbor first. Go ahead, it's okay. Does anyone know? I'm gonna tell you, so don't worry if no one really knows. All right, so this is a neuron. And I'm gonna actually show you another picture of a neuron. This is not what they look like when they're in your brain, but we can culture neurons in a dish. And this is very early on in the culture, and we actually went to the edge of the dish. They like to grow in clumps, so we went to the edge to see a single neuron. I think the lights are good. It's okay if they can kind of just imagine. Otherwise, people are going to go to sleep, and I'm going to get insulted. So I bet all of you, without being scientists, could understand that if this part is green and this part is red, they're probably not the same. And you're exactly right. They're not the same. So this green center, that's called the soma, or the cell body. That's where the DNA is. That's why I'm here for DNA Day. These like little green thready things coming out, those are the dendrites. And what dendrites are is they're receiving signals from other neurons. And this red, this is the axon. And the axon is giving out signals to other neurons. And so the kinds of machinery you need to give out a signal versus the kind you need to receive the signal are two really different kinds of things. And so in order for a neuron to form properly, it has to get things to the right place at the right time. So if it's destined for the dendrite, it's got to go out here. If it's destined for the axon, it's got to go out there. And this is really true for all the cells in our body. So I put another example of a cell up here. This is a kind of cell that you have in your pancreas, part of your digestive tract. And this type of cell, see these little black circles? Those are filled with digestive enzymes that are going to go into the duct, and then the duct is going to empty into your small intestine. So when you eat a meal, these little black things are going to fuse up there, and then the digestive enzymes are going to get released just in time to get all those goodies. So down here, this is the nucleus. That's where the DNA is for DNA Day. And you can see that it would be terrible if the nucleus was up here blocking those black things from being able to get out. So it's down there. So you might think, well, of course, it has to be down there. That's how it works. But you see, there's a process that makes that happen. What's that process? So if you want to study a neuron, or you want to study this kind of cell in our digestive tract, you can try. And people do. And even in my lab, we try to study neurons. But it's so difficult. First of all, you really can't study it in the whole animal. You just can't. It's too complicated in there. There's so many kinds of cells. And second of all, when you take it out and you put it in a dish, it's still complicated, trust me. And then it's not even behaving the way it should. So what we do is we use this thing in the middle. And I'm wondering if anyone knows what this is or wants to just take a wild guess. It's a yeast, my second favorite organism. Actually, my third. People are my first, and you're going to see a picture of my dog. But this is a yeast, and people who work with yeast think that yeast are adorable. So see my little adorable yeast? And what's so interesting is that this is the whole organism. It's a single cell. You wouldn't be able to see it. You need to see it with a microscope. And this bigger part is the mother cell. And it grows by producing a bud. It still has the same issue of how do things get from the right to from one place to the other at the right time. Because now something has to go from the mother to the bud. And it turns out, because of evolution, basically the genes in the yeast and the mechanisms in the yeast are the same as the mechanisms in a neuron. And that is an amazing fact of life that we're just really starting to realize now. And so we can study a process in a simple little organism that's cute, adorable organism, and we're going to learn something about neurons, about digestion. And that is really what I'm going to show you today. So it's not just me. I have a lab. It's a team of people. And I'm showing you this picture for a few reasons. First of all, you can see that really is a team. But also, remember I said, I want to convince you, you can be a scientist. You can see I have people in my lab, they're from all over the world. They're all really happy. The weather's always great in my lab. Just kidding. That was last summer. There's the cute little animal, my dog Milo. And so people think of scientists as being in the ivory tower and a little bit autistic, that can't communicate with others. But actually, scientists are really social people. They love parties, or at least I do, and I'm a scientist. So, and we love working in groups, and we love meeting new scientists and learning about from new scientists. And that's why I'm having a good time right now, learning from Brian and just being here meeting new people. Okay. So we work with what I consider the good yeast. So there are yeasts that cause diseases, not this one. This one's called Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Does everyone want to say Saccharomyces cerevisiae? Great, but we're going to call it yeast. It's more friendly. So this is actually like a cultivated organism. It's a pet yeast. They've been cultivated for thousands of years. The same kind of yeast that we study in the lab is used to make wine, and in fact was probably first cultivated from grapes. You know, when you go to the grocery store and you look at grapes, there's that kind of white bloom on the grapes. Those are yeast. So this is probably how they were first identified. And then people realized, oh, we can use these same yeast to make beer. We can use these same yeast to make bread. And in fact, I love making bread, so I work with yeast at home also. Now, I think one of the big hurdles to imagining how you're going to be a scientist is you think, how do you get those ideas? And in fact, for most of my science life, I was nervous about how would I get those ideas? So I'm going to share with you how I got these ideas and how I imagine other scientists do too. I don't really know. But for me, I love reading about other scientists and other scientific experiments. I read The Double Helix when I was in high school, and that actually was a huge influence on me. And you just look at, what do other scientists do? So I'm going to tell you a story about one scientist, a short story. His name is Lee Hartwell. And when he first started his lab, he was studying Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And he was looking at them under the microscope, and he noticed that these yeasts grow by budding. Everyone knew this, but he was noticing it for himself by looking at them under the microscope. So here's the mother cell, and when it's ready to start to divide, the first thing it does is it makes a little bud. And that little bud gets a little bigger. It gets a little bigger. It gets a little bigger, and finally, this is big enough to be a mother. It comes off, and it starts the cycle again. And he suddenly realized, you know, how do human cells divide? What kind of cell cycle do they have? I bet it would be kind of like a yeast. And so I'm going to study the cell cycle because I can see the cell cycle just by looking under the microscope. If I see a yeast without a bud, I know it's at the beginning. If I see a yeast with a little bud, I know it just started. And if I see a yeast with a big bud, I know it's getting close to the end. So I can just figure these things out by looking. All right, so then how could he really do this? So this is how he did it. He decided to try to get mutations. And so really, if you were listening to Brian's talk, it's the same kind of thing. A mutation doesn't mean like you're the monster from the deep. These yeast mutants are still yeast. They're just not exactly like most of the other yeasts. And mutation doesn't necessarily mean bad, you know, blonde hair or brown hair. These are due to genetic differences. It doesn't necessarily mean bad. But if you can figure out by sequencing the DNA what's wrong or different, you can figure out something about how something works. So what Lee Hartwell realized is, if I want to know how does the cell cycle start, I should look for yeast mutants that look like this. Because this one can't make a bud anymore. It can't start. But if you think about that at all, you realize, oh no, you can't get that kind of a mutant. Because if the yeast can't make a bud, it's not going to grow, and you're never, ever going to be able to detect that kind of mutation. So how did he do that? What he did was he took advantage of this trick called getting a mutant that was temperature sensitive. So yeast like growing at 73 degrees, just like me. Yeah, I like 73 degrees. And they can usually grow at 97 degrees too, just like me. I can grow at 97 degrees, I'm just not as happy. But what he decided to do was to look for mutants that could grow at 73, but they couldn't grow at 97. So that way he could find the mutant. So basically it works like this. He had his yeast growing in the culture, and as we know, There's a spontaneous mutation rate. In this case, he added a mutagen so he would have a higher frequency of mutations. And then he took them and he plated them out onto a plate. And he took this plate and he made copies. And we still do this in my lab. It's called replica plating. What we do is we have a plate, and then we have a little round disc with a velvet on it, like the kind of velvet you wear. And you take the plate, you smush it on top of the velvet, you get a copy of each colony. You take a new sterile plate, smush it on top again, and now you have an exact replica. And we can put one plate at the 73 degrees and one at 97. So anything that was mutated so badly that it got stuck here wouldn't show up. Those go away. They can't grow. And anything that's still totally normal at the end is going to grow on this plate and this plate. It's only the ones that can grow on this plate and can't grow on this plate that he went and analyzed further. And by going through this process in a very painstaking way, he went around the entire cell cycle. And he identified several genes that people still study. And now we know that when they're mutated, can cause cancer. And it's just been so interesting. And we've learned how these genes function. And some of them actually end up functioning in the brain, not for the cell cycle, but for some other kind of regulation. So this was huge work. And for this work, he won the Nobel Prize back in 2001. And I'm assuming that everyone knows what the Nobel Prize is, but if you don't, it's kind of like the gold medal for the Olympics. So these are the superstars, and they're truly my heroes. And there are at least two other cases of the Nobel Prize being awarded for people that use yeast in a very similar way. And in fact, one of them was just awarded this fall using yeast to study secretion. And in all of these cases, I thought, wow, I wish I could do that. I wish I could have an idea like that. And I always felt like it's kind of too late. All the big questions were answered. But that is so not true. So don't worry. So about 9 years after I started grad school, which is a long time, so I had graduated, I had a PhD, I was in another lab, and I did some more research. And then I went to a second lab for a second postdoc. I made this discovery by accident, that the yeast vacuole, or lysosome, and for this talk, we don't need to know what that is. It's this green glob, is inherited. It's transmitted from the mother to the bud in a really organized process. And I am going to show you a movie of this. And what you're going to see is this thing's going to kind of dance around, look pretty cute. See, it's very adorable. And there's going to be some tubular vesicular structure that's going to rapidly migrate to the bud. And then something really interesting is going to happen up here, but we're going to ignore that for today's talk because it's too complicated. So I'm going to show you the movie. I'd like you to look at the movie and see if you see anything in it that you find interesting. And you can talk to your neighbor too. So the kinds of things that interested me were that it seemed like a lot of activity was going on over here, but not over here. So why is this part different than this part? There's a reason. We still don't know the answer for that. And I was also really interested because it looks like once this thing starts to go, it knows exactly where it's going. It's not going all around on kind of a random walk. It knows exactly where it's headed. And so taking this clue from Lee Hartwell, we decided to just get mutants that can't do this, to learn how does this work. So one of the first mutants that we ended up with was a mutation in a molecular motor called myosin 5. So molecular motors are what they sound like. There are these molecules in the cell that actually can walk along a track. In this case, the myosin walks along actin. So, and a lot of people study molecular motors. And the main thing that people study with these is How do you get power out of a protein? And people still really don't get it. How do you get power out of a protein? But the kind of mutation that we got focused our attention on this other part of the molecule that people hadn't been studying it. And we called it the cargo binding domain because it looked like this is the part that was attaching to the cargo. So if you don't know what I mean by the word cargo, you could think of like the passengers. So this is the train engine, and then this is attaching to the passengers. Okay? So suddenly, my lab was studying how do the passengers attach to the motor? And other mutants led us to some of the answers. So we found these proteins that no one had discovered before, so we got to name them. And in yeast, everything has a three-letter name, so it's not cute like Drosophila. So we called them VAC8 and VAC17, and you can think of them as Legos. So we found out how a motor can attach to the cargo is you need specific kinds of Legos. We still study this. All right, so I could tell you a lot more about this. But in the interest of time, I'm going to go to the next kind of thing that we discovered. And this was this very understudied signaling molecule called PI35P2. Now, this is not in the textbooks yet. It is really, really important. And almost nobody studies it because it's a pain in the butt. And I knew when I first started to study it, this is trouble. And in fact, there were several times when I thought about backing out from this project. Because at least with molecular motors, other people studied them. So other people knew something about them. But here we were really pioneers. And believe me, sometimes it got very scary. So why did I end up studying it anyway? It was really this kind of experiment. So I'm going to try to explain this experiment to you, and I'm going to ask you, what do you find interesting about it? Actually, I'm going to ask you something easier, don't worry. Yeah, I'm going to ask you something easier. So one of the reasons why this molecule is so hard to study is there's almost none of it in the cell. It's just a tiny, 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 tiny bit of the cell. So that makes it hard to measure. And we accidentally discovered that if we took our yeast, and so here, this is zero time. So we have our yeast, they're happily growing, this media tastes lovely. We dump in high salt or too much sugar. They don't like that. They go, yeah, we hate that. And then there was a response. And the response is, within 1 minute, they make 5 times more of this lipid. And within 5 minutes, they make 20 times more. So suddenly, the levels are easier to measure. And this made sense, right? Because we took them, we did something to them, and something changed. But here's the part that was odd, or got me really curious. We made the change here at zero time. They go, yep. But then there's a plateau, and the levels of PI35P2 come down. But we didn't make a change over here. We didn't make any change. It was the same as what's going on here. So what's going on? Why does this come down again? And so I started thinking about, well, what in our life is like that? I think this is a form of adaptation. So what kind of events in our life do we experience adaptation? Does anyone want to take a guess at that? What kind of things do we do where you notice it and then you don't notice it? Someone said music something. Say it again.
Say it. In the elevator.
Music in the elevator. Exactly. That's exactly right. What's another example?
Your pupil reacting to light.
Your pupil reacting to light, you see? And so I was trying to think, how could I do something as great as Lee Hartwell? Honestly, that's what I was trying to think. And I saw this and I thought, adaptation. How does adaptation work? Who knows how that works? And now I have a model for adaptation in the yeast. So I am going to study this project. I don't care how hard it is. So that's what happened. All right, so are we getting to the neurons yet? Oh, we're getting there almost any minute. But just in case you don't believe me that we're studying something real, we could go back to the microscope and we can see that at that same time where we're seeing PI3-5P2 levels go up and come down again, we can see a change of in the vacuole size gets smaller, then it goes back to normal again. So it really is some kind of adaptation. Don't ask me how it works yet. We still don't know. But we're still studying that. Okay, so we were going along a merry way and we're thinking, we are studying something so important. We are studying something so important. And my mother's saying, yes, you are studying something so important. But everyone else is saying, that is cute. That's all. So I was thinking, it's not just cute. And then one day, Miriam Meisler, who's a faculty at the University of Michigan, came to me and said, we've discovered a mutation in a human patient that has something called Charcot-Marie-Tooth syndrome. And this can be a mild syndrome or it could be really severe. And in the case of these affected individuals, it was really severe. They couldn't walk, they couldn't move their arms or legs. So really, or didn't have control over their arms and legs. So this was an awful disease. And she had found this single amino acid change, so we heard about that. And this change looks like it really wouldn't do anything bad. But because this is a gene that we discovered in yeast that makes PI3-5P2, we could actually go back to the yeast and see what happens when you have that exact mutation. Does it have any effect that we can measure? So we went back to that assay of looking at PI3-5P2 levels go up and down in response to high salt. And we found that in this patient mutation, the levels go up, but they don't go up high enough. And so what we think is that PI3-5P2 is really important. It's really important in the nervous system. And it's really important that it can be regulated dynamically, that it can change. So that's what we learned. Now, the way that science works is it is very social. It's like Facebook. We publish a paper, other people see it, and the next thing we knew is other people were finding diseases linked to mutations in FIG4, the same molecule required to make PI3-5P2. So probably more people here have heard of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. This is an awful disease. And again, these patients had very minor mutations. We could see in the yeast what the problem was, but it was very, very subtle. So again, this is emphasizing how important it is to dynamically change the levels of this lipid. Because these, in all of these diseases, the PI3-5P2 is still made. It's just the dynamic changes are gone. And the most recent paper was just published last month. And this was a single amino acid change. Now, in this case, it was homozygous. And the affected individuals all had epilepsy. They had serious behavior problems. They all committed suicide. So this is linked to neuropsychiatric problems. And we'd like to understand how. So this is a very cool website here, the Allen Brain Atlas. You can take any gene that you want, type it in, and you can see these images of where these genes are expressed in a mouse brain. And here we went and we looked at FIG4 as well as the other two genes that we know that are required to make PI3-5P2, and we found they all show the same pattern, and they're quite elevated in the cerebellum and in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is where learning and memory takes place. So we were really excited about that. And we decided to try studying this pathway in hippocampal neurons cultured in a dish. So in the beginning of my talk, I showed you a picture of a neuron from a dish. And again, here's a neuron growing in a dish. And now this neuron's been growing in a dish much longer, and it's made lots and lots of dendrites. That's what all these fat things are. And these more spidery looking things, these are probably the axons. And Brian mentioned in his talk about interest in the synapse, right? So this is where the axon is meeting the dendrite and where the communication is happening. So there are these molecules called neurotransmitters. And in the hippocampus, it's most commonly glutamate at the excitatory synapses. Glutamate is in these synaptic vesicles that are docked, and there's going to be a signal, and then they're released. And this is so highly regulated. There are the breaks. We don't want too much release. That would give you epilepsy or some kind of hyperexcitability. We don't want to have no release either. That would be like a zombie. We want to be kind of in the perfect zone. And then over here in the dendrite, there are neurotransmitter receptors. That's what receives the signal. And again, it's highly regulated. We want the perfect amount of neurotransmitter receptors out there to receive the signal. If we have too many, it's too excited. That's like epilepsy. We don't have enough. That's like being a zombie. And what we're starting to find out is that PI35P2 is really important here to make sure that the perfect amount of receptors are there. And some hints from our lab and another lab say that it's also going to be really important here, monitoring whether a synaptic vesicle should fuse and release its contents or not. And I'm just going to show you one experiment that shows us that. So we can actually do electrical recordings from a neuron in a dish. And what we should see are little spikes once in a while. So this is the normal. If we don't have enough PI35P2, these spikes get way too big. And that fits with this idea that PI35P2 is putting on the brakes here and putting on the brakes here. And so what else would we want to know about this? Tons. You know, so one thing, I get fooled every time. We just start out and we say, we want to ask a question. Here's our question. We want the answer. Turns out we get the answer, but then for every answer, there's 10 more questions. So the kinds of questions we're thinking of now are, how are the levels of PI35P2 regulated? Because I showed you, regulating them is so important to their function. How does that happen? Well, how are we going to figure that out? We're going to figure that out first in yeast, because it's easier. So that's what we're doing. But we'll also go and test our models and our hypotheses in the neuron. And then, well, what in the world is PI35P2 once it's made? What is it regulating? And we're trying to figure that out. So we know a few things that it regulates, but we also know there are many more things that it regulates. We want to know what those are. And how are we trying to figure that out? Again, we're doing this in yeast. And if anyone wants to know later, I can explain how. It's very cool. But again, when we find something in yeast, we're going to want to know. Is that how it works in the neuron? And then what other diseases are due to defects in PI35P2? And that's what I'm asking Brian. Autism? Yeah, maybe we should talk after this talk, right? And then, can we find drugs that can change PI35P2 levels and provide a treatment for some diseases? And surprisingly, we have a way to look for these drugs in yeast. And so I'm going to stop here and just emphasize again that we can go from yeast to consider new information about human diseases. We can take information from human diseases. We can study models in neurons. And we can also take information from human diseases and go back and model those disease genes in the yeast to see how they really work. And then I want to just, again, remind you that this isn't just me. It's a whole team of people in my lab, and actually several other wonderful labs at the University of Michigan that have joined with us to do these studies.
OK, in your little movie where you showed the things going places, So, obviously, they're riding along a track to that new place. What is it that that determines how that track gets there? Is there just a connection of those microtubules or something like that that are always there, or is it like built there specially after the budding starts?
That is a great question. So the track is actin. It's actin cables. And that's part of, actually, the picture that I showed at the beginning. I didn't explain everything, of course. This is actually showing where the actin is. And you can actually see the actin cables. So the cables are set up, and they're oriented so that things will move into the bud. And a lot of things move into the bud. So I just showed you the vacuole to be simple. But it turns out this motor that we found moved the vacuole. We also found moves mitochondria, another kind of organelle, peroxisomes, secretory vesicles. And actually, one of the big questions in my lab that we're asking is how all of these different cargos can be moved by myosin 5. And we have started to answer this even at the atomic level. We have a structure of that cargo binding domain. And we've now mapped where all these different cargos bind. A lot of them overlap, and they compete with each other.
So there's different neurological diseases derived from disruption of synapse, like too many neurotransmitters, or the neurotransmitter that can't really connect to the receptor?
Yes, I think that's great. I mean, that's a great idea. And yes, I think a lot of the epilepsies are due to some kind of defect in the communication. And probably depression is due to defects in the communication. And so a lot of the focus in neurological disease research is on the behavior at the synapse.
I have a question. You're saying that the PI352 regulates the connection between the synapses. What regulates the PI352?
Yeah, see? Okay, so first of all, it's not the only thing regulating the connection between synapses. I mean, that's a little bit too megalomaniac for me, right? There's a lot of things that are regulating it. But that's exactly right. I meant to have that on my questions. What does regulate PI352? Yeah, I don't know where you are in life, but if you want to come to my lab and figure it out, that would be great.
I have a second question. Do we get that through the whole body, and where is that stored, or does that just come in naturally?
Yeah, so that is a great question. Oh my God, I hope you want to be a scientist. I really do. So PI352 is made in our bodies. I don't think we would get it from our food, because I think that we wouldn't be able to absorb it. Like when we eat yeast or other, so this PI352 is found in all plants and animals. So I'm sure we eat a lot of it, but it's very low abundance. But I don't think it could get into the cell. It's made there.
Figure out a way to regulate the amounts of PI-392 in yeast and humans, or just yeast?
We can't really even regulate it in yeast yet. We have a few yeast. We have some mutations in yeast that don't make enough, and we have some that make too much. And we're using these mutants to try to figure out how it's regulated. And we have this idea in my lab of how to screen for drugs that would actually modulate it. So again, I think if you're thinking about doing science, you'd be a great scientist. These are wonderful questions.
In terms of the funding, the research, is there challenges? Because as I'm sitting here listening, I'm thinking to myself, you know, give you millions.
Oh my God, God bless you.
I have 100 questions, but I'm just wondering, are there challenges?
Yes, the challenges, especially for me, because I think most people see my research and they think, that's cute. Because I can't promise them I'm going to cure autism. I have no idea. I can't promise them I'm going to cure neuropsychiatric disorders. I don't know. I can't promise them I'm going to cure cancer. So this is exactly my problem. I'm trying to figure out how to argue, like, to Congress or to individual private donors that they want to fund basic research too, because these are where the real leaps are coming. And that's why I started with Lee Hartwell. He wasn't in the beginning trying to cure cancer. He just got curious. How do you get a bud? So, oh my God, God bless you. Go home and talk to your friends.